Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Microsoft Corporate Vice President and Chief Information Security Officer, Brett Arsenault.
Well, look, I have two. What do I do? How is everybody? Now, come on. I come in the afternoon, you get security in the morning. I saw they talk about security of Windows 10. How are we now? Freaking out? Okay. Did Mike do the thing where he scared everybody and said, "I'll come and fix all the room"? Like, I get a broom and I sweep up behind him. Did he do that this morning? Because he's done that to me in the past. He's like set me up, so I make sure I'm not. So I have on my Seahawks tie. Sorry, it's my Sherman tie. If anyone watched the game last night, so I should just push this across the line apparently and create some kind of a call. I never wear a tie, but I had to do this for the Seahawks thing. So apparently I have 39 minutes and 27 seconds to assuage any concerns you might have about security. I will tell you, I'm going to set up for failure. But I won't be able to assuage all your concerns about security. I'd rather keep it interactive and have questions. So I'm going to give a little bit of context around the questions I think that would be great to ask. And then we'll generally just talk about my role as a CISO at Microsoft is protecting Microsoft data. So I really have a role similar to what you do or your security team does. I'm not here to sell you a product. I don't have any quota or anything else like that. So all I can do is share what we've learned from the team that I run. That's how we protect Microsoft and the principles we use. Does that make sense? So if you want a product thing, I'm not going to be able to do that. I will tell you there's one product thing I will talk about because I'm betting a lot of the company on it, which is some security features and enhancements in 10. I know they talked about some of those for you today, but I'll give that a bit, but the only product thing I'll talk about. So probably talking about user education awareness, how we talk to the board about security, what we're doing. Does that make sense? Okay. So before this, I was the Chief Technology Officer for the Identity and Security Products Division. And so then I became on the operations side in IT, which is a funny thing. It's an evil thing to do to someone, is to tell someone who built something to now go implement it and find out it doesn't actually work exactly the way we designed it. So that's been a very good educational experience for me over the last 6 years. But that being in mind, I'm just curious. I saw the numbers on the size of your security teams, which is very interesting to me. I really would like to start with just a couple of questions, and then I'll go to. Is that okay? That way I'll share. So what, given that I come from the product side and now for the last 5 or 6 years I've been on the operational side of protecting the company, what are the top things you want to discuss? Because if we don't, you'll be stuck with a bunch of slides. I didn't want to bore you with demos, and I'd rather have an interactive conversation. So with that, I'll just take, if I could, a couple of. Did you zoom in on this tie? I just want my mom to know I wore this tie. Top things on mind for you around security, what's going on in your organization, if you could let me know what industry you're from. Anything? Anyone?
Insurance.
What's that?
Insurance.
Insurance? Cyber insurance, or you're in insurance?
We're in insurance and we underwrite cyber insurance.
There you go. And this is a person you should talk to at the end of the day. Now, there's a different question about what things are covered and what things aren't. So Jason and I can have this conversation after, but that is a conversation we've had with the board, is how much protection do we need and where are we? So that's a very good question. That's one good question. Other questions or thoughts that you might have? Anyone? Anyone? I'm gonna let her take the mic here and then let you bring the mic down here to follow that one up. So let's go over to this side. The first question is the microphone.
I think I can speak loud.
Go ahead, I'll repeat it. So the question was, some of the carriers are providing enhanced cybersecurity. How are we using it, and how does that play into the stuff that we're doing? Okay? I'll tell you, I don't use their stuff. I work with Ed from AT&T all the time, but we may be in a little bit different scenario why we're not using that today. But I will answer that, and we'll do that as part of the question. Here we go. Constraint. Anyone here? Raise of hands. Constrained budget? How many people are going to double their budget in cybersecurity next year? Okay, I want to come work with you. I'm all in for that. What's that?
Sony Bell,
exactly. It's actually a really good question on constrained budget. And I think the question was, if I remember it, in a constrained budget, what should you be spending your resources on? And yes, that's one of the best board questions is, do you have enough money to do what you want to do? And the answer is, I never have enough money to do what I want to do, but if you let me protect the company I wanted to, we wouldn't be in business. So there's a line between business enablement and how much we want to go spend. And I can talk to you about, this is probably one of the more interesting questions. I'm going to save this one. I like this one. Constrained budgets. How much on cybersecurity? Just out of curiosity, how many of you know how much you spend on your security protection as a percentage of overall budget, IT budget? Okay, for those of you who know, how many of you is it more than 5%? How many have more than 10%? How many less than 5%? Interesting. We're about six to seven. I will say that it goes in waves. There's a big bow wave you'll do if you're like, if you think about this from a perspective of technical debt or accrued liabilities. Like we'll see in technical debt, there'll be a wave to catch up, whether it's in your wireless network or other components. And so it's not steady state. Steady state, we're probably 4%, but you'll see, and we're doing investments. And I'll talk a little bit about the investments we're making now, which is why we'll see bow wave in this space. Another question, then I'll, and we'll keep, yep. And I'll work these into the conversation. That's not the only part to the answer to your question.
So one of the statistics that was given out in the morning was 90% of successful attacks happen from phishing.
Yeah. Is that Mike who said that?
Yes.
CNN. What can I say? Go ahead.
So the question is like, you know, what are you doing towards it?
Yeah.
So that's the most important place, I guess, too.
Yeah, we should. First of all, I love Mike. I'm not trying. I'd like to tease him a little bit. Phishing is a huge factor, without question. It's not the only thing I'd be worried about. So I'll talk about that in just a second. That's a good question. I got two more, and then one more, and then we'll go. If these aren't the things you want to talk about, you better put your hand up now. Otherwise, this is the path we're going down. I like the constrained budgets path, too. Yeah.
So back to the insurance question. How do you value your risk?
How do I value my risk? It's so funny you should ask, because the meeting before this was our enterprise risk management meeting where we take operational risks up and we differentiate between risk and threat, obviously, and I'll walk you through the model we use for that today. How do we evaluate? Good, I like that. There's one more back there. Oh, it's my microphone.
What can we look to Microsoft for in terms of things like EOP, right? So Exchange Online.
Yep.
Versus having to add in other solutions like a FireEye or other kind of ATD. I guess sort of what can you share, given that we're already paying Microsoft, it's already there, there were supposed to be some changes earlier in the summer. Can you share some of that roadmap and perspective, what you do, of whether it's more Microsoft or, again, having to add in additional products?
Yeah, I can. I'll caveat there. Remember, I'm not the perfect product pitch person. I'm sure there's a whole room over there right now yelling at me and mad at me. Sorry, Doug. I'll tell you what I use. So I do use FireEye today as an example, and I use EOP, and I use a number of other elements. So I'll walk you through the things we're using and the things that we've announced that are coming, and I'll give you a statement of direction on where we're going.
Yeah, and I just to follow up, but specifically on email, right? So there's kind of the FireEye, but then there's the FireEye email product, right?
Yep.
That if our understanding kind of EOP is supposed to sort of evolve to take that FireEye email piece.
Yep. If you just want to talk about email, I can, and I can give you an overall strategic view of how we think about security probably differently than some as a vendor in this scenario and how I count on that to work. Yep.
Hi.
That's a great one.
Related to, I guess, the costs and budgeting with limited budgets, how do you prioritize which data is most important and, you know, tiering your security?
Ooh. Oh, I like that one. Okay, perfect. That's a good place to start. Let me just, all I really want to do is give you an idea how we think about the problem, how we prioritize, and what things are on my big risk list, and the things that I would do in a constrained environment, what are the things I'd focus on first to try to provide the most amount of protection for the right amount of money. Does that make sense? And probably also dispel some of the myths in the things that we read or hear about in the paper. Okay. Not if, but when. So the question around how do you think about data and classification of data and protection of assets and critical assets? One of the most important things that we had to work on was fundamentally understanding what were the core principles as a company that we're trying to protect. And I think I see a lot of security programs where people aren't really, I'll just say they're more reactionary. They're more of a whack-a-mole game than a chess game. And so being super clear on what the core principle protections, the protection principles you have are, they're different for every company and every business. And so one of the things, we meet with Satya every month with our CEO to review security strategy, security plan, current threats, whether they're internal or external, what we've learned from those, and then to the question about risks, what exceptions are we taking that we should be concerned about and reconsider how we prioritize and budget for those things? This is very different than our management of the past. It's a very hands-on approach to how we should go do those things. And so in this scenario, some of these will seem obvious and some of them changed and are modified over time, but they don't change much. So every time my team comes to me and says, I want to do a view of an insider threat program. And the question that I ask is, okay, across these four areas, what am I getting for it? Am I getting protecting customer data? Is it device integrity? Is it the supply chain? Which piece of this is this really applying to, and how much return am I getting on that? And so this is a key piece for us as we think through that. So as a company, protecting customer data has always been important, just like it is for you and your customers. But certainly with the advent of us now hosting and operating a whole lot of platforms with your data on top of it, it's exacerbated how important that ability for us to protect customer data is. I always cared about it from a PII perspective or a HIPAA perspective in our insurance programs. But now that we have this added responsibility, and you'll hear a lot about this in the trusted cloud principle stuff you'll hear from Horatio this afternoon on how we give you assurances on where we do that. But that's changed the way we think about some of the investments and the prioritizations that we do. So while we encrypted a lot of the external types of work that we used to do, now we're hardcore about protecting all data at rest and all data in transit, no matter which platform or which space it happens to be in. So it changed our view about data. By the way, this is an ordinarily ranked list. And I will tell you, 6 years ago, it was a little bit different. Number four would have been higher in the stack, which is protecting our IP, right? And our intellectual property is not referring to our source code. That's part of our IP, but clearly marketing plans, product release plans, launches, and all those other things are all part of that. And interestingly, to the question about how do you value data, a lot of the IP we have is very time-based data. So after we release, there's not that much interest or value in that any further, and so it has a different set of protection mechanisms around it. Ensuring device integrity is super important to us for two reasons, and it has moved up in the stack of things we care about because of two things, frankly. One, we didn't do that much with devices. So between keyboard and mice and things like that, that was one thing. Then we did Xbox. That was obviously important that we could protect the platform and that the gaming platform was good. The transactions and the credits and things that go along with them weren't compromised or being fraudulently used by anyone. But then you add to that mobile devices, Surface, and other hardware pieces, and making sure that is critical for us for two reasons, really. One, when I took this role, we had a really good team that, as you can imagine, a software company does very good software application security. But a really good secure application on an insecure piece of infrastructure doesn't really help you out all that much. And now, when we've shored up infrastructure and application, that being on a piece of hardware that you can't really assure is safe from when it boots up to the time it gets to the OS actually instantiating itself also doesn't really help you very much because we're seeing attacks in those spaces. So we want to make sure from beginning all the way through to the end to the application running, we want to be able to base that on a fundamental concept that the device is completely secure. The second reason for that is, and I believe the Windows 10 folks talked to you about it before, we have to get away from passwords. And we have to get to a multi-factor model or biometric model that will work, whether it's iris, facial, or fingerprint. Take your pick. But it has to work, and it has to be rooted in hardware. And so for us, like today, we will rely heavily on TPM, both for protecting data and identities. And if I have my way and we have this conversation in the spring or at latest next year, I'll be rid of all passwords. And everything I do will be, and this is all part of the stuff we're doing in Windows 10, but it will be rooted in hardware. And so again, I need to make sure the hardware is actually really good. And that would be one of the most impressive feats we could get done if we can. Protecting the supply chain, we have always cared about. However, as I mentioned before, our supply chain originally was mostly digital. So my nightmare scenario, well, there's a lot of nightmare scenarios in this role. I think I've said this joke before, but when I took this job, it's amazing. I sleep like a baby. I wake up at 2 crying every single night. Particularly on December 22nd when I got the call about the worst movie in all times, The Interview, and you'll hear about that this afternoon. They'll tell you the story from about 3 days after I got the phone call, which is really a very interesting story, and I'll let them tell it. But that keeps me awake, but that doesn't bother me as much. That's a rights issue, and should you be able to allow to do movies and all the other things. What worries me most is we update 1 billion machines a month, and it's digitally signed by Microsoft. And if someone was to inject, this happened to Adobe, but if someone was to inject a piece of code, a malicious piece of code, into that system, which is called Windows Update, I became the fastest malware distribution center known to mankind. And so that is what keeps me up at night. That digital supply chain, from development to update to pushing to all the machines, that's critical for me. Always has been. We have a very This goes into the most, this is called a high value asset and goes into a special enclave that we run. Very expensive, wouldn't scale it for everything, but that's super important. What's changed is the supply chain, now that we're in this manufacturing component, for again, Surface, Xbox, phones, and other things, is we're spending a lot more time around factory security and a much bigger supply chain than we had 5 years ago. And so I just say that's something new. And when you say, where am I investing resources? If you're in manufacturing, you already understand this. We've done it, but not at the scale we're doing it at today. So that's the place where we're investing a lot of incremental dollars when I was mentioning the budget changes that we have going on there. So we think those are really the four core principles. The good part of this is these are the four core principles no matter where you are. Whether you're in the IT function, or if you're the Windows group developing product or services, or whether you're in Azure or O365, they all apply. And so this is consistent across the entire company, and I run the Risk Management Council that we run this across all the groups inside of Microsoft. But having this is super, super critical. And so if you don't have one, I'd strongly encourage you to do this before you spend a dollar, because it helps you think about where you should go do those things. I know it seems like simple and mom and apply, but I'll say it's been super helpful for us in how to better prioritize our resources, but also to be really, really clear about what things we're trying to protect. The second thing, and all these protection principles, goes back to the classification component. We have lots of systems, lots of different tools, many that you use, many third party. And at the end of the day, what we really try to think about is the data we're trying to protect. It's because I want to get it to a data element so that it doesn't matter if it's on my phone or whether it's on my on my Mac or whether it's on my Windows device or whatever device it is. And we need to continue to drive it to the data level, and we need to make sure that we're investing a lot of time in what data stewards' responsibilities are. Users are data stewards, but so are collections of data. SharePoint Online site is a good example. You're the data steward, and we have a very simple classification model, really. It's three simples: low business impact, moderate business impact, and high business impact. And for each one of those, they have a different set of control objectives. Those control objectives are applied consistently regardless of device or location. So whether I'm using a third-party software as a service provider, which we have some, I run the same set of criteria for HBI data there as I do for my own cloud, as I do for my on-prem solution. There's 212 controls. We map to what those controls do. If they meet the controls, we can move it over there. If they don't, we have to provide workarounds to meet the control objectives, or I risk assess it. And I do a risk acknowledgement and say, for this business reason, I'm willing to take on more risk, but I'm not going to get that control feature. So I'll give you a good example. I forgot to mention one other small thing. So business continuity and disaster recovery is under my remit for the company. And so let's talk about 5 years ago when I came here. I'll walk you through a risk acknowledgement process we went through and a design decision trade-off for where I want to spend my money. How many of you run Exchange today? And how many of you run online? Interesting. How many of you who run on-premise? So show me who's on-premise, Exchange on-premise. Okay, keep your hands up. It's just fun to do this. Okay, for all of you who have an on-premise and you have a backup, a fully redundant backup recovery model that gives you active, keep your hands up. Otherwise, take your hands down. Ah, interesting. And how many of you are using SunGuard to make that happen? Aha, okay. So here's the thing. It turns out no one should feel bad with this. So when we looked at it, about 50% of enterprises in the United States actually don't have full recovery capability for their messaging systems. Partially because they don't believe they'll go down, and partially because they're expensive, and so that's fine. So when we went through and did the BCDR, the business continuity plan for Microsoft about 6 years ago, it turned out our own Exchange system had so much redundancy built into it with three geographic locations where we ran from our data centers, we actually didn't have a full active system capability, which, if you're familiar with Microsoft, it's an unbelievably male-centric culture. And so that was news to us. So we said, okay, well, what's it going to cost? Let's call SunGuard and a bunch of other people and get dark fiber, CPU, and storage capability. And, of course, their systems are massive. And it was about $18 million to go build this out. That's a lot of money. Now, for us, there are critical assets, critical processes, and critical people. There are 5,000 people who are on the critical list for this company to run. And so those people, regardless if something ever happens, those 5,000 people have to be able to do their job. To be clear, the list is kind of a funny list. It's not as perfectly concrete. There's probably a few people that should be on the list who aren't, some people like me who don't really need to be there. But that list is important for us because then we said, okay, we should build a BCDR system for exchange for those 5,000 people and drive the cost down, and then we'll build a longer-term solution. Or, hey, we have this other wonderful mail asset known as Hotmail, now Live Mail, now Outlook.com. And make sure everyone's following along. I don't market this stuff. We could also build that capability out of band to work there as well. And there's cost and process to go do that. So we basically built a plan for the 5,000. Why? Why wouldn't we build it for the whole thing? One, there's a cost constraint. And two, there's a better way to do it. The better way to do it is build it into an online service that already has the ability of understanding how to do data caching and dynamically keep data up to date in various places and has massive data centers around the world for us to make this thing go work. And so instead of spending $18 million, we spent less than $1 million, built enough for the 5,000 so we could make the thing run. That's why it's called disaster recovery. We worked with the product team and spent 18 months building it into Exchange Online. So you can have less than a 4-hour RPO and RTO for your data. I saved the company $18 million, and we all in this room who are using the online service get the added advantage of having business continuity disaster recovery capabilities at a cloud service that are just a native part of the service versus an add-on part of the service. And so there's one of those examples of we take the principle, and we think, how do we go apply it online in a more cost-effective way that doesn't just benefit me as the first customer, but for the rest of the customers who would go use it? Does that make sense? And so it's a good thing about a good way to think about how to prioritize. And so what we did was we risk acknowledged that for 18 months we were going to have a window where some people might not be able to work. When do you think we exercised that list of 5,000 more than any? Come on. First of all, raise your hands if you're from west of the Mississippi. And raise your hands if you're east of the Mississippi. And I mean this globally. Go all the way back around till you get to London. Okay, so east side people again, remind me. Snow drivers, have you ever been in Washington when there's a snowstorm or even a hint of a snowstorm? It is the most amazing thing to watch. We have 27 plows for the entire city. If you happen to watch the Monday night Green Bay football game from, I don't know, a couple years ago, I have more snow capability, removal capability in my garage than we have at the football stadium. So we have none. So if there's even a threat of snow, nobody comes to the office. I get it's hilly, but they do this wonderful thing in Washington, which is they just park their cars in the middle of the interstate and walk away. So the plows can't even get through because there's just abandoned cars all the way down 405. I don't understand it at all. But when our systems get tested the most is our remote access capability anytime there's a storm, because all of a sudden 60,000 people are trying to come in over our RAS lines. So we prioritize the 5,000 and we work through it. So it gives us a good test every year when we think there's going to be a snowstorm. That's a good thing to keep in mind as you go through that. Why is BCDR in the security space? It was a reason why I wouldn't take the job the first time, which is, not saying you have to put it there, but again, when we think about it, confidentiality, integrity, and availability of data are the three things you're trying to accomplish. And so availability of systems may not be a security issue. It may be an operational issue, a storm. It may be a natural disaster. So we think of response in the same way, which is that if we think of overall business response and critical response, it should be in that same platform. So that's just one of the things that we've learned. What about the motivations that we see? So we see three motivations that still drive these things. And this has been consistent for a very long time. There's criminal motivation, which is usually financial. There's espionage, whether it's nation state or corporate espionage, which is around IP theft. And then there's this hacktivism thing that's in the middle. And that's just to be disruptive. There's no real motivation. One last question. Who plays tennis in the room? Anyone? Anyone play tennis? Is the worst thing in the world to play a beginner? Why? Because they don't know where the ball's going either. Right, and the problem is with a financial attack, 80% of the time it's going to come from outside your firewall. It will not come from inside. So you can tune for and think about it very differently. IP, exact opposite. 76% of the time it's going to come from inside your firewall. And so again, you can tune and do it differently. Hacktivists, there's no rhyme or reason. You don't know why or where they're going with it. So they're probably the hardest to predict, but you can still work on them. And so again, while you think of the protect, detect, and respond capabilities you want to have, I will say that in the last 5 years, there's been an immense amount of shift in effort for me, both financially and resource-wise and people time, in how you do response capability. Because if you believe it's not if but when, the differentiator for most of the things you'll see in the press is how well they can respond and recover from the incident, as opposed, I'm not saying you don't still protect and detect, That's not my comment. But my comment is you have to be really good at exercising your response and recovery capability and the resilience of your systems, which goes back to why business continuity and disaster recovery, we're living in the space, actually makes sense. So we continue to see these as the primary motivations that happen. But this is the scary side. But what's interesting is if you look at every breach you'll read about in the paper we get involved with in one way or another, or at least I've had the opportunity to, they haven't changed. In 20 years, they really haven't changed much. They're not going after the off-to-the-right APT thing. They're picking on old techniques. They're picking on old models. The only thing that's fundamentally changed, and there's only been really four well-known cases of it, is this idea of a disruptive attack, right? So as opposed to in the financial world, what you'll usually see is a smash and grab. They'll go in, they'll get what they need, and they go. You may know they're there, but they're gone. In the IP world, it's more surreptitious. You want to be in, you want to lurk, you want to do reconnaissance, you want to never be detected that you're there. So it's super low key. In the disruptive one, you go in and you want to be undetected. And when you leave, you usually want notoriety, but you want to have been undetected long enough to plant some damaging things to happen inside. This is why the second Sony situation was such a big problem, was because the entities that were there were super smart about what they did. I'm not saying I agree with it. I'm just saying they were smart with what they did. But they destroyed backups before they brought the systems down, so when they went to recover, they were unrecoverable systems. That's tough. That's really hard. So they leave behind destructive malware. Same thing in Saudi Aramco. I only talk about public ones. Saudi Aramco, same thing. 30,000 machines brought to their knees. You don't see many of those, but they're not motivated by IP or by financial. They're there for disruptive purposes. That's the one that's causing so much noise and all these things. Steel mill in Germany, same thing. And so that's the one where having response, resiliency, and recovery capabilities will really differentiate where you think about and how you spend resources on this. That make sense? And so the good news is, that's the scary side. That's the one Mike talks about. The good news is, and a little bit to counter the phishing comment, which is still 90% of any breach you've read about was avoidable with 5 low to moderate cost fixes. Keep the machine patched, keep the OS current, make sure you have antivirus. I know it's not as effective as it was 10 years ago. It's still effective. Do not go away from antivirus, regardless of what you may read. Have good identity, which means for me, you can provision the identity and you can deprovision the identity quickly, right? That's a huge piece of this. And then lastly, monitoring. And these are more expensive as you go down. Monitoring is the one that will cost the most amount of money in this scenario, and it's still low cost relative to other advanced persistent threats. So if you look at that 10% off to the left, which would be one or two standard deviations away, it's more than 10%. That's the low case frequency that happens in that scenario. So if you're doing your 90% hygiene work, you're still better off than most anybody in that scenario. I'm not saying you're perfect. You're still, if you have a nation state attack, if you have a determined adversary, it will happen. So you're going to have to think about the recovery capability. But I see tons of people spend a whole lot of money on these massive advanced threat tools, and yet they haven't done the basics yet. And that's the most fundamental, in particular in small and mid-market, it's the only way to do it. Because otherwise, you could spend your entire budget on all these different places, and it wouldn't give you the same amount of protection as these 5 things. Now, I don't have enough budget, but I'm not crying, because I'm sure it's probably more than some. I always want more. But the big thing for me is, how do I shift the budget that I'm doing for things that are not adding value and that are operational and move those? And so for me, obviously, moving our patch components that we do against our 50,000 servers plus all the other things that happen in IT, yet alone in our data center for our cloud services. But getting patch, OS concurrency, and antivirus is a basic part provided by the cloud provider, which for us is Azure, whether it's in web service or in infrastructure as a service. By moving all that out, I take all that cost off my table. Now, you won't agree, you may or may not agree with me. I don't say to my boss, that's money I'm giving back to the business, because I'm not. I'm using that money to go out on the 10% and work on the hard problems. So I'm not right now planning on reducing the security budget. I'm not growing it either. The way I'm redistributing the cost is to take the commodity stuff, move it to the cloud, move it to the provider, and then reapply it to the things that are more valuable, like getting deployment of all the biometric stuff we want to go do in Windows 10. I will say the next thing I would love to see move there is identity. I'm not there yet today. Azure Active Directory is amazing. It does wonderful things. I just have so much legacy that I'm working with that team today to move all of our ideas. We use Azure Active Directory, but I also have on-prem. I would love a model where we agree that I get all my identity out. I don't want to manage any more Active Directory servers. I don't want to manage the 7,500 password resets a month that I do today. I want to get that down to zero or shift that cost to a more amortized view that's a cloud-based view. I think I'll still have to do the HR onboarding and offboarding piece, but I think the actual management of the directory and the intelligence of the directory is something I can get, and I do get from the cloud service today. Right? Because they have so much better, we have so much better telemetry about all the identity trends that we see in that space. And so that's the other piece that I'll see moving there. This is another example, though, where as a company, it's interesting to me when I think about the cloud. So we had another scenario where we had a successful phishing attack against us. And in that phishing attack, to your point about phishing being very effective, what they got access to was, because of bad user hygiene, they got access, they found a way to phish some people and get their passwords to go use their social media sites, LinkedIn and Facebook for HR for recruiting as an example. Okay? And so not a good thing, not excited about it. It happened, risk is pretty small. But when it happened, it was very interesting how the team found it. We responded to it. We instantly put it into our education and awareness program for all of our employees to take advantage, as opposed to this once a year training. You could train them real time while there's an event happening, while you get mindshare, and why they need to do things differently, and why our tools, you know, why we want to change the policies and protocols we use. And so it was super effective from an education and awareness perspective. But more importantly, you know, when we found this, we also noticed that this particular adversary was going after about 10,000 companies in a campaign. And in that campaign, we said, well, what do we do about that? Well, we could send out the IOCs, which are indicators of compromise, so you understand it, make routing rule changes, mail filtering changes, and a whole bunch of other components. And we posted those. And someone in your company may or may not have come to our website and looked at that or gone to somebody else's site and tried to see those. But that was a good socially responsible thing to do in terms of transparency and control. We also noticed, though, some of those 10,000 companies actually have a relationship with Microsoft and happen to have Premier support agreements. So we had those Premier people call the designated contact in your company and give them the same data, which then went to an operations person who then figured out what to do with the routers and what to do with the mail service, and if you have Exchange online or on-prem, go make those changes. And if you're lucky, in some period of time between, let's say, 8 hours, and depending how quick the response is, 72 hours, you could go impact those changes. Then there's a third group of people in this 10,000 targeted customer base. They're Microsoft customers, but as opposed to just having Premier online, they were actually in our O365 cloud. And for those customers, we just immediately removed all the threat, removed the mail, and it was instantly gone from the system. So my security team finds it, and then we apply it to everybody else who's in the O365 cloud. And with no operational implications, you get that protection that comes with it. And so there's certain capabilities that as we go to cloud services, whether it's around business continuity and disaster recovery, or whether it's around better sets of intelligence because we can see trends happening by industry and other components, we can actually take faster action. And essentially, you can let my support team or my security team work for you. Because if you have less than 5 people trying to protect your company, it's hard to keep up with all the threat stuff that goes on. It's really, really hard. So it's one of the best ways to scale and amortize that cost. So that's why I use the cloud for that piece. Now, and then that's the part where I tell my boss, he can't have the money back. I just need to redistribute it to the advanced threats. In the last 3 years, the other thing we've obviously seen this transcend itself into the boardroom. We talk less about the technology, and we talk with our board about the risks and the components that are there. Are we spending it on the right thing? From a sharing perspective, what I'll tell you we see is a little bit different is talking about the top 10 risks that I'm working on and where we are, and are we, you know, essentially it's really simple. I'm way better than I was last year. Relative to my competitors and my partners, I'm here. And relative to where I want to be, I'm never where I want to be. So I always want to spend. But what's more interesting is not where we spend money in the top 10. The real question that most boards want to know is what's on the margin line for you that you're not spending money on? So of that top 10, what was 11, 12, and 13 that you decided to cut and they haven't funded? So if you find yourself in the paper, you can't say, oh, I didn't know about that. Well, we did know about that. The Volkswagen situation is very interesting as it rolls out. And so this is one of these things where we continue to see that be a board-level issue. We also see a lot of pressure from that segment to not scrutinize what the money is being spent on, but how effective the controls are in this space. And so having a plan, and we use the NIST CSF framework to help have that conversation. And if you don't, you can. It's easy. It's inexpensive. It's international, and it's an amalgamation of a number of public policy standards, not a set of new ones. So it's actually fairly easy for us to do, but we find that to be very effective. And so when I think about it, that list, and so the way we do, to answer the question about risk, it's really simple. We look at probability of an event happening and the impact of that, and then whether it's material relative to what our audit group tells us it is. And then we just stack rank, and we have control effectiveness. So you get your inherent risk, your control effectiveness, and your effective risk left over. And that's the thing that we're always measuring and mapping to. And so that's how things bubble to the top. And we do that for security and operational risk the same way we do it for all risks. So we have four risks in the boardroom: legal, financial, strategic, and operational. And security falls under operational. So it's the same model, same numeric metrics, same mapping, and you can look at it across the entire company. Does that answer the question? There's over here, we asked the risk question. And so, and of course, there's two things from materiality. There's reputational risk and financial risk. And then you'll see a lot of these, especially for us, they're reputational. Because so many people are entrusting their data to our cloud, even if it wasn't a direct impact to their data, it may undermine their trust in our platform, and so therefore it have reputational impact. And again, Horatio will talk to you about how we think about trust in the cloud later today. So that making sure I do the questions. So that's a big component of it. As far as overall plan, we still tend to think of security as an adjective in the product and service offering. We're not a McAfee, now Intel, a Symantec, et cetera. We think that every workload should just have security baked into it as part of that offering. So Exchange Online Protection is one of those. Rights management services that apply to the data in the cloud is another, an adjective that adds on to that. The question specifically about FireEye, if you're familiar with FireEye, they provide, obviously they have a response capability, but they have a network tool, a web tool, and an email tool. And they do wonderful correlations between them. I use their network tool. And we have a product called Sonar that is a customer preview tool now that is essentially the same mail capability that now is turned on in O365 to the question about what we're doing there. And then we also acquired ATA for identity analytics for anomaly detection and identity. And we just acquired Adalom, which will add more protection in terms of encryption and document recovery. And you'll see us continuing to add in those spaces. The other big things we've done, and again, Horatio will talk about some of these, but was also the idea that encryption's great, but you need to own the key, not me. And so when you see the way we do lockbox in O365, if I have the key as your vendor, that doesn't help. It helps you. It's a good thing to do, but it's better if you have the key. Frankly, I don't want the burden of it. You should have the key. It's your data, and you deal with all the fees that happen, all the things that go along with that as part of that custodian chain that you would normally run. And so we see that. Same thing and these are things you won't be able to do at scale on-prem. The same thing with the Azure services. So forensics capability now in the IaaS service, we run virtualized forensics services throughout that whole service. Any single instance in our IaaS service now has forensic capability built into it. So that's the product roadmap piece that you asked about. I talked about risk. I talked about Exchange Online Protection, data protection. Did I miss anything? Budget, did we talk about budget? A few times, right? Was I clear about what I'd prioritize? If I wasn't, let me go back. I would make sure that you do these five things. And if you can't do them yourselves, then I would get a managed security service provider to do it, or I'd look for a cloud provider to go provide the more expensive ones. If you do those five, then you should have the conversation about the other components that go in that space. We did trends. I love these slides. And the last thing I'd leave you with, which I think is what people struggle, and I love this, if you're familiar with Sun Tzu and the Art of War, which is, if you know yourself but not the enemy, for every victory gained, you'll also suffer defeat. I see lots of people who do this. They spend a lot of time with their infrastructure. They know it really well, but they don't think about what the outside actors are, the three I just talked about, and how you think about where they are in your environment. If you know neither the enemy or yourself, obviously you're going to lose every battle. And so that's not a good position to be in. And then, of course, if you know the enemy and you know yourself, then you need not fear the result of 100 battles. And it's that knowing yourself and the enemy and where you're invested and what you're thinking about is probably the most important. So I'll finish with a question. because I'm allowed to do that, I hope. How many of you feel like you're in category one? You know yourself, but you don't know the enemy. It's okay. Okay. How many of you feel like you know neither the enemy or yourself? Interesting. And then how many of you feel you're in the, you know both? I'm going to ask the one that they didn't predict this is, how many of you feel like you know the enemy because you read about it, but you don't know yourself? See, there's a few of those. So that would be my closing statement. I did want to do questions first, so I'm grateful. I'll be around after. I know there's a break for any other questions, and hopefully at least give you an idea where you should invest and how we think about solving the problem. Thanks. Have a great day.